Launched in 2020 as a resource for teachers navigating the COVID-19 pandemic, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is a podcast about all things early childhood teaching. I'm Dr. Christine Lippard, and each episode I interview researchers, classroom teachers, or other early childhood practitioners on a specific early childhood education topic. Intended to provide research background, practical ideas, and cheering on from a distance, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is the long-distance mentoring your teacher prep faculty wish they could provide. Today I'm joined by Dr. Jen Newton, an assistant professor at Ohio University. Jen has a PhD in special education and a master's in early childhood special education. Her research includes strength-based approaches to families, early childhood inclusion and equity, and inclusive teacher preparation. She also has an Instagram account that she uses to disseminate her work broadly. You can find her on Instagram at Teaching is Intellectual. So originally the podcast started to be a resource for teachers entering fall 2020 when all things COVID teaching were new. And now that feels kind of funny because we're on the second year of it. Tell us a little bit about your experience, you know, either starting March of 2020 when the pandemic was declared or, you know, going into last fall. And then how is it still impacting your work?
That's such a good question. It's hard to imagine that we're still having this conversation. I certainly didn't anticipate that. So I was like everyone else. I was in Chicago meeting with some friends at the Nora Project doing some work, and I came back here for spring break. So I had just gotten home. We were on spring break and the school said we're going to extend to a 2-week spring break at this point. And so we were sort of like, okay, well, we'll just hunker down for 2 weeks. And then here we are like 21 months later. I was really fortunate in that I did have that time to build relationships in the first half of that semester with my students in person. I was teaching students outside of my program. I was teaching elementary teacher candidates at that semester. And so that was a little bit nerve-wracking for me because I had my own program of students to also check in with and try to make sure that the plans were all in place and everyone was feeling supported when I didn't really know what I was doing because I am program coordinator for the K-12 program. I think for me, the biggest switch, because I already don't grade work and I already engage students in self-evaluation, and I already have flexible deadlines, a lot of the things that were coming out in support of faculty shifting their teaching in that way were already things that are typical practice for me. So I wasn't feeling like those things were challenges, but I did feel like there wasn't support for me in my particular challenges that I was facing, which was more about structuring our learning opportunities, what were the appropriate expectations to have for my students, what to do about the fact that none of them could now go into the field. And we had field assignments that were pertinent and critical for us to meet our licensure expectations as well as our accreditation. So those were the biggest concerns for me, and I didn't feel like I had a lot of support in that. So one of the things I really have shifted toward now as we continue. I was very lucky in the sense that my university supported us teaching online all last year. So I wasn't in a position where I was having to teach in person in a mask with some friends on Zoom and doing all of those things at once. So I was really lucky in that sense. We were all online. We could set up the meeting times in the way that made sense for me and my students. And we knew what we were doing. And once we knew what we were doing, everything felt a little bit more manageable in the sense that at least it wasn't constantly shifting. As a parent, there were those challenges as well, right? My partner and I were both working from home. We have 3 kids who are also going to school remotely. So demands on our rural internet, those kinds of challenges. I think for how it's still impacting my work, what is most pressing right now is the lack of opportunity for our students to get in the field. We continue to have very real struggles with collaborating with our area schools because schools are doing the best they can to limit outside exposure that's unnecessary or not critical to their mission. And so for my early field students, my juniors, for instance, who are in there, that's the year that they should be in a year-long field experience. 150 hours each semester. And here we are at the beginning of week 7, and all of my students are not placed yet with teachers. So last year we didn't have any field experiences. This year we thought we would, and we're still continuing to struggle with that. My interns, what used to be referred to as student teaching, all of the interns are placed, but if the first time you've ever been in an extended field experience is your senior year, right before you're graduating and you're doing the EdTPA, it's very unsettling. And so I think there are some widespread impacts on the pipeline that I haven't seen anyone talking about. And to me, that is probably the ways in which I think the pandemic will continue to persist in our work and in the ramifications of our work going forward.
We are certainly, have had similar struggles. Our field experiences are spread over starting second semester, sophomore year. You should have some sort of field experience every semester, and a lot of semesters too, because we license birth through third grade. So you usually have an early child, a before kindergarten and a K third. And they did their K third virtual last year.
It is challenging. It is so challenging. And I've been thinking a lot about how we can potentially measure some of the impact. I'm seeing it in their self-efficacy, right? I'm definitely seeing that their self-efficacy has been negatively impacted, and their sort of confidence in themselves as developmental teachers. I think they already feel like they're not where they should be for where they are in time. It's very common for them to always feel like they're not ready to go into the field, to take that first job. I expect that. This is new. This is a new level of insecurity about teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to tap your expertise for other things too, because I could talk ed prep all day. So, as we shift from sort of short-term crisis mode to long-term with the pandemic, the podcast is shifting as well to talk more broadly about early childhood teaching. And one of the gaping holes that I was aware of all last year was to really give some dedicated time to inclusion, both inclusion the way we tend to think of it in early childhood, and then larger diversity, equity, and inclusion ideas that are being talked about, at least across academia right now. So it was discussed in a variety of episodes, but not super focused time. Could you, just to sort of set a foundation, talk about how you define inclusion and how you think about it preparing future educators related to inclusion?
I mean, it's my favorite thing to talk about. Inclusion to me is about belonging. It's a mindset that is not necessarily about time or space. It's not the where a child is served, but how they're served and the ways in which they're belonging in the space that they're included in. And so all of us, I think, are included or excluded in certain spaces, right? And so it's about whether or not we have an affinity group there, whether or not we've built community in that space, whether or not we are acknowledged as having strengths and something to contribute. And all of those things are critical to developing a system of inclusion in early childhood. Early childhood systems are built exclusively. We have a bifurcated system in early childhood where we have a typical system that you go through when you're born. Your parents select childcare situation for you. It may be at home childcare. They may be accessing childcare through any number of different social supports within states or federal supports. Hopefully those are going to increase as we get through this next budget. We're hoping there'll be lots more investment in early childhood, so more and more kids will have access to high quality opportunities in early childhood. But that's only true if you're a typically developing kid. And there are lots of, and I don't even like that word, but that's how we'll frame it for right now. There are lots of ways in which that system in and of itself fails a lot of kids because of the underpaid faculty and staff who work in those settings, because of the lack of investment from the federal and state government to support those teachers in their own professional development, in increasing opportunities for them to learn, to have smaller class sizes, to be able to do creative things with resources in their communities, right? There are ways in which those systems are already failing a lot of kids. We know the preschool kickout expulsion suspension rate is really high, and that's for typical kids in typical community centers. They just don't have the resources or the access resources in order to support lots of different ways of being for young children. And child development is incredibly important for us to understand and constantly be learning. And every kid that we meet that challenges our notions is an opportunity for us to learn, but our systems aren't built like that. So that ends up being one sort of route that families can take. The other route is that, one, if a child is born with a diagnosed disability, say spina bifida or Down syndrome, or develops in a way that indicates cerebral palsy might be a factor, those are the kinds of things that will put you on a separate pathway. Now, that happens from the very beginning. You'll get access to early intervention, which is Part C of IDEA, which is the law that's developed and designed in order to include children with disabilities in educational opportunities. So Part C is a separate system. It goes, you know, you're home-based. You might be in a community preschool or community child care center or a home child care center, but your provider will come to that place and work with you or work with your care provider, work with your family. Maybe you'll meet families, you know, at the McDonald's playground. I used to do that a lot when I was an early interventionist. So those are the kinds of things that are available for those kids. But when they turn three, they automatically transition into early childhood special ed. So at that point, we've completely gone in separate paths because those school-based classrooms are not available for community kids. They're only available for kids who qualify for services and supports under IDEA. It won't only be children who have diagnosed disabilities at birth. It can also be children who have been multiply kicked out, right? We might consider that there are developmental delays at play, that they, we also factor in other things like family conditions and environmental structures. We might think about trauma. We might think about a variety of different things that might be impacting that child's development. So once a student qualifies for those services at the age of three, they transition into school-based services. So at that point, there's two different models going on for preschool. We have school-based early childhood special ed, and then we have community-based as well as some state-funded preschool programs, right? Like some state-funded, like in Virginia, there's a preschool initiative program for kids who qualify. Because we don't have universal pre-K for all nationally, there are lots of small state and local systems for supporting kids at threes and fours. But they're always exclusionary of kids who qualify for services and supports of IDEA. So we already have separated them. So at this point, and you know, a lot of those separations are just based on resources, based on terminology, based on, you know, kind of trying to do what we have with what we know to be best at the time, not necessarily based on what's best for kids. So when I think about inclusion, I think about how can we create opportunities for belonging in those spaces, and how can we create opportunities for community engagement where children are able to be in their neighborhood schools, in their community preschools, where other kids that live in their neighborhood and shop at their Target, shop at their Walmart, shop at their Dollar General are, rather than the ways in which they're separated now, which just creates exclusionary experiences for young children because they don't get the opportunity to learn from each other or even about each other, right? They don't know that there are these other systems that exist. So I think that's broadly how I would define inclusion when I think about how to prepare future educators about like creating these inclusive environments. One of the things that I've really started doing a lot of is teaching them disability history. I think oftentimes they come into prep with the same segregated, you know, they've come through the same segregated system. So they often think, well, I worked at a summer camp with kids with disabilities, or I volunteered in the special ed hallway at my school, and I think that's what I want to do. And in the first couple of weeks, when we're talking about disability and we're trying to define it and we're trying to think about who gets to decide who's disabled and those kinds of things, they say things like, well, they just want what we want. And I try to challenge them to think about who decides who's they and who decides who's we.
Right.
Who's in the we. Crip Camp has helped a lot. We watch Crip Camp on Netflix. Now we watch it like in the second week of class because it does really help them to see the perspective of disabled advocates and disabled people who are saying like, this is unjust.
Okay, and hold on. Back up and say that again so that, well, one, so that I can find it. And two, if other people are interested. So you said this is a Netflix show, documentary?
It's a documentary and it's currently on Netflix. It was produced by Michelle and Barack Obama, actually, and Judy Heumann, who is a disability rights advocate who worked for the Obama administration. It is a really great documentary that goes through their experiences at camp, in Camp Jened in the 70s, I think. No, it would have been the 60s, I guess. And then
And it's called Crip Camp?
Crip Camp.
Okay.
And the thing I love about it is that it touches on Willowbrook, which is always included in when we're thinking about disability rights. I also get into the Kennedys, but it touches also on or it spends a lot of time actually on the Section 504 sit-in, which students never know anything about, and the Capitol crawl that happened for the ADA legislation signing. So those are important pieces of how policy and advocacy interact and the ways in which we as teachers, as educators, as civic professionals have to engage in politics. So that's a great place to start. If you haven't seen it, you have to watch it.
Yes, I will have to. You just said like three things that I'm like, oh, I do not know enough about that. Okay. So I will. I'll start there.
It's awesome. It's okay, so good.
So I interrupted you. You were saying that it's really that you start with history. And it sounds like also these stories, like individuals who are telling their story as a place to help your students start to think. And then you were also talking about this idea of you didn't call it othering, but that's sort of where I've been parking my thinking of helping students think about who determines who is they and who is we, and what is the importance when we make those distinctions. I think that's where you were.
Yeah. And you know what you reminded me of when you were recapping is that that's how I use social media. So this is how social media has come into sort of inform my work, but also I think make it more tangible and accessible for my students. So in the 3 years that I've been engaging in public scholarship using social media, primarily Instagram, I have found tons and tons and tons of disability rights advocates and disabled people and families of disabled children. And all of these people who are talking about the ways in which we as special educators and the system of special education is failing kids. So the way my syllabus is built now, I have people in social media spaces for my students to check out every week. So I want them to be hearing about, and I think one of the things we do poorly in special education is that we talk about disabled people without including the voices of disabled people. Mm-hmm. And so I point them in the direction of own voices every week so that they're getting exposure to the fact that the language that we use when we say things like they want what we want is problematic and why it's problematic. And also that this is how they've been conditioned, that ableism is a part of our conditioning. It's a part of the structure of our schooling. And so it's becoming aware of ableism and how it shows up and how it takes up space in our conversations in education. And that has been a really important part of preparing future educators to think about inclusion differently. You know, historically, and you will know this, but historically, the way we talked about inclusion was this idea that you were just saying like, we'll put all kids together in one room and close the door and then they're included and that's what we do. And that's just not it. It's such a pervasive myth. No one is saying that. No one believes that inclusion means just putting kids with specific support needs into a gen ed classroom and leaving. That's not it. We have to provide the supports, but we can do that in ways that are more flexible and more natural than self-contained classrooms. So our gen ed classrooms are not working for 100% of the students who are in there, right?
Right.
So we know that maybe somewhere between 40 and 60% of kids are benefiting from just gen ed structured the way it is. And that means whatever that gen ed teacher has decided. But we can implement certain things like universal design for learning. We can think about flexible grouping. We can think about collaboration. We can think about scaffolding. We can think about all of these things in ways that allow students to all get their needs met, just in flexible and diverse ways. So it's not putting everyone in one space. It's changing that space so that everyone can be in it.
And I think that is so critical. A lot of this is influence, I think, from things that you've got me thinking. And so we'll make sure that we connect your Instagram so that folks can find you, but not just that everyone can be in it and not just, you know, I think we very quickly go to, well, make sure the tables are the right height for a wheelchair to roll up to them. But also the idea that there would be things that were familiar to everyone and enjoyable to every, not that every child is going to enjoy the same things, but are you making sure that inclusion really includes children fully, not makes the same children always adapt their interests, their skills, their interactions, whatever it is, to engage in the same way? And so we're talking about inclusion in children with disabilities. I just spoke virtually at our state conference last week and was talking, I talk about infants and toddlers a lot, and was talking about dual language learners. Is somebody always hearing the songs in their second language? If so, they're not fully included in the songs and music that are happening in your classroom. And it's not that everything has to be tailored for any one particular child. It's that nothing should be tailored. You know, it shouldn't be tailored for any one particular child. Anyway, I'm getting on a different soapbox, but I think this extension of that I think you often challenge me with of not just is there room for everybody at the table and can everybody physically get to the table, but is everybody interested in being at the table once in a while?
Yeah, and that's really a fundamental concept of UDL, right? The Universal Design for Learning. It's not that we create individualized lessons and opportunities for each child. It's that we ensure every child has the opportunity across the day or across the week or across the lesson to engage in ways that are meaningful and powerful for them. Mm-hmm. And that's a shift we have to make. We have to shift from thinking, you know, this is a challenge that I get all the time is like, well, it's better for some kids to be in self-contained classrooms with smaller class size. There's, you know, there's always these really consistent reasons why segregation is okay for some students. And the research just doesn't pan that out. Kids get less instruction in self-contained classrooms, like significantly less instruction. There's no access to peers, to the rich language opportunities and environments. It's a very tiny, tiny, tiny number of students, far fewer than we have excluded right now, that truly wouldn't benefit from inclusion of some kind. The other thing that I want to sort of clear up since we're on the topic is that inclusion doesn't mean I'm in the gen ed classroom 100% of the time. I would challenge us to think of whether or not being in the gen ed classroom 100% of the time is best for anyone. You know, in our RTI world, we're definitely doing flexible grouping, hopefully across grade levels, pull out, push in for a variety of different things for different kids who need those supports or don't need those supports, right? And so that is also true for inclusion. Inclusion isn't about 100% of your minutes being in a gen ed classroom. It's about you having a space there and that students know when you're missing, right? And your classmates look around and go, hey, shouldn't he be back by now? Those are the kind of components that I think we should be looking at for measuring whether or not we're inclusive.
So much good stuff. Like my brain is just buzzing. For the sake of your time, I'm gonna jump to the like, okay, but I'm a first year teacher. What do I do type question. We were chatting about our weeks last night at dinner and I told my husband about this conversation. And he was a secondary ed English teacher for two pretty miserable years and could have used more support. And he said, well, all of this is great. Every teacher out there wants to do these things that you're talking about, but they exist in a system and in a school and in a set of rules. And I said, yes, we need to work on changing those. And he said, great, but when you're a first-year teacher. So I will extend that question to you of teachers who are trained differently. They didn't get to have you or your perspective. They were trained in a more traditional, this is your SPED class and this is your gen ed class, and your pedagogical content knowledge from here never touches your special education knowledge from here. Or they were trained in it, but they've landed in a school where that's not valued and that's not the way we do things, and our co-teachers and whoever have different perspectives. Where would you tell new teachers to start?
So a couple of things. One is absolutely. Absolutely. The system is deeply bifurcated. If we get into the law and the way IDEA is written and the way ESSA is written, we're implementing our charge incorrectly and inappropriately, and I think unethically, definitely not in accordance with the spirit of the laws, both of them. Special education is supposed to be uniquely designed instruction, services, and supports for kids to access the general education curriculum. It was never intended to be a separate system of delivery. It was never intended to be a separate curriculum, a separate graduation track. I think when you're in secondary, especially if you come up through content secondary, you can go through, because depending on what you teach, right? If you're an AP teacher, this doesn't feel like it's anywhere near your problem. What's really wild is that a lot of kids who would do well in, for instance, AP English are not given access to that because of perceptions about their abilities based on the service and support needs. So there's that problem, right? Is that we make the assumption that the system is working for those it was designed for, meaning that kids who do well are accessing those higher tier classes. But really, there are lots of kids who are prohibited from attending those classes. And we know that statistically. There are lots of Black and Brown kids who are not given access to those opportunities. Lots of kids who have the services and supports they need to do those, to be in those classes, who then aren't given access to those classes. So there are a lot of ways in which we use special education and access to services and supports to sort of prohibit access to higher tiered courses for students as they move up through middle and secondary. So back to the first question you asked, though, about the students who haven't had access to this, I think that's pervasive, right? There are very few gen ed teachers, and a lot of special ed teachers are still being prepared in a very deficit framing of disability and with a very medical model around our job as special educators is to fix kids so that they don't need those services and supports, so they can go back into the gen ed classroom and just be like what we expect everyone else to be. Yes, the truth of the matter is
to make them match. I'm learning this a ton from learning more about the autistic community, that the goal so often is, well, how do we make them match?
Yeah, it's that idea of masking, right? How do we teach you to cover up who you are so that you can look like everybody else? But the truth of the matter is we all have supports, right? Like I have a pretty significant anxiety disorder and I don't call people on the phone. Well, when things have to be, you know, appointments have to be made or whatever, I ask my partner to make those phone calls and he does that for me as an accommodation. There's not like it's time to wean you off that accommodation. It's just like, that's a support that's there for me and I'm able to access it. Right. Those are things that we have to shift our thinking about, right? It's not, everything isn't about withdrawing the supports. It's okay if a support is working, let's keep that support in place so that the student can continue to benefit from it. The other thing I would say is like, it's really important, and everyone will tell you like, read the IEP. Yes, every gen ed teacher needs to read the IEPs. But if you don't have any experience with any of this, it's not going to be super meaningful. Spend time with the students. Try to build in opportunities to get to know the students individually and understand what it is that they need from you, what it is that they are potentially not feeling particularly confident in, the ways in which they may have benefited before, even in higher ed. I think, and I don't know if you're noticing this, but I'm certainly having the experience where I'm having more and more students coming into teacher candidacy who are identifying as having received services and supports in K-12 for things like learning disabilities around like comprehension, reading comprehension, or, and so they'll say things like, I got these supports, but it was always focused on withdrawing the support. So now I don't, you know, ask for any services and supports here because I feel like I don't want people to think that I'm trying to like work the system or whatever. And I think that's really interesting because I think a lot of special educators, it seems like there's an increase in students who are like, I didn't really like the way I felt in this process. And I want to make sure that other kids don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. So I think also really spending time getting to know the student and how they identify and how they describe their own learning experiences is really important because that'll help. That'll help us to think about how we can help them be learners. And then finally, and I give this advice to everybody, but just presume competence in your learners, right? Believe in their ability to learn and believe in your ability to teach them. And that in and of itself is really powerful. If we have low expectations for students, if you're like, oh, I mean, this happens all the time, right? I have 3 IEP kids in my third period. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That right there tells me all I need to know about how well those kids are going to do in your class.
Right.
So thinking about the ways in which we position these things, and that's why I've really shifted to using language around services and supports, because we need to really name them. What are the supports the student needs? An IEP is a legal document that outlines what the school has agreed to do, but we have IEPs because schools won't provide reasonable accommodations unless they're legally obligated. When we shift away from thinking about the IEP as this burdensome, you know, document that we have to collect data in a certain way, but really get down to what are the services and supports that will benefit this student and how can I collaborate with the student to ensure that they're accessing the curriculum? That's all you need to do. And I think every teacher already does that or wants to do that. But just looking at individual students and asking them about the ways in which they feel the most competent as learners. I do this at the beginning of the semester. I have like a Google form that I send out to all my students and I ask them questions about what pronouns they use and about the ways in which they identify, what supports they benefit from in learning, what things they don't like about certain, you know, what, think about a class where you really didn't like it. What was it about that class that you didn't like? What makes you feel unsafe or incapable in a learning environment? Ask kids that.
And when I think about the idea of services, focusing on the services and support, I think that also, I'm thinking about a lot of things. I'm thinking about like asking 2-year-olds that, and it's like, well, they're not going to answer you back, but you can watch and you can tell, right? Like, if you have a circle time that's 30 minutes long and you have some 2-year-olds that aren't hanging in there, that tells you, that gives you some feedback that's really important. But we didn't start with the whole foundation of like have developmentally appropriate expectations first, which I think is a given and I've talked about in other places. But when you start to talk about this idea of services and support, you know, I imagine as a teacher, that would make your brain light up and go, oh, you know who else might benefit from that? Or, oh, this is actually something I could make universally available in my classroom. Or I think you would get less hung up on, I have to do this IEP, and more, what would be good for everyone in my classroom? What would be good for support, targeted support, and maybe feel a little bit less like you're trying to do 17 individual plans.
There is absolutely no way to overstate that. Like, the vast majority of the accommodations that we have available to us as special educators are just really good pedagogy and teaching skills for all students.
Right?
Yeah. So that, you know, we have work to do within the teaching community professionally to unpack the why we hold on to certain practices that aren't accessible for everyone. There's a certain amount of meritocracy that persists in education, right? The cream of the crop mm-hmm. idea, best and brightest. And that seems to come with it some of this bootstraps mentality that you should be able to knock down every barrier in order to be the best and the brightest, rather than we'll help you dismantle those barriers so that we can allow you the space to achieve And dismantling barriers that are unnecessary is a huge part of making sure that your classroom is accessible. And I think helping teachers to think about the ways in which they might be inadvertently creating barriers is really important. So one of the things I talk about a lot with like middle and secondary teachers is get with your team, right? Or even your school wide, make decisions about things like where you put your name on the paper so that all kinds of teenagers who are dealing with executive functioning challenges, because that's ripe in that time, in that age range, they can learn one way of doing it and do it that way in 7 classes.
And you say that for middle school and high school, but I will tell you, if I learned nothing else from COVID, it was the idea that executive function is a limited resource in any given day, in any given semester, probably not in life, right? You can recharge, but honestly, we're all in the middle of like a year and a half long trauma. So we're running low on it. And I had more students comment on the organization of my class website as beneficial to their learning than anything else I did, which maybe I shouldn't be proud of, but I spent a lot of time making sure that they would not use up executive function trying to hunt down what they were trying to access.
I love that.
But that, I made sure that when they opened the front page, there was a big button for the Zoom link to get to class, right? So if nothing else, they could get to class. And there was another button they could click on that would tell them everything they needed to do for that week. And I think people thought it was spoon feeding, but honestly, if I'm only going to get, I need a unit of measure, but if they only have so much capacity to give my class, and I really want to target where that capacity is going, I definitely don't want it to be in figuring out where to write their name or
100%.
Or how to find the reading. Like I want it on the content and the good stuff. So I love that you talk about that, because I think that it's true for all of us, and it's so true right now for all of us, but especially when you think about adolescents and emerging adults and what their brain is trying to take in.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, when you're shifting, I mean, like, sometimes we're talking about 42 minute periods. So there's the transitions are constant for some learners.
Right. And then what, 8 minutes in between where you're trying to think about what's the best route to get to my locker in the bathroom and to my next class.
Yeah. It's just a lot for them to figure out. And we sort of double down, right? We're like, it's up on my board. I have it there every time. You can look up there. I have all these cues in place. Yes. And they're doing that all day long, which I love your point that it's a finite resource, right? And in any given day, kids only have so much executive function to give. I mean, all of us. So I think that's a really important thing that we can think about. How can we kind of dismantle some barriers that are accidentally taking up space and making things challenging for students, and they grind our gears, right? Those are the kinds of things that those routines pieces that if students aren't executing them proficiently and consistently, we get really frustrated.
Okay. Can I take that to a preschool version?
Yeah.
That I maybe just need to get over. Maybe it's my own soapbox. The moving your name around to where you're playing. Are you familiar with this? Like,
yeah, that was
picture name tag. You have to take it with you from center to center when you're 3 or 4. And the amount of times that you might notice a friend is in a center, want to go over there, but by the time you hunt down your name tag and get there, there are too many people, and the like conflict and tension and frustration that happens, it just to me feels like an unnatural barrier. Like if 4 kids can play well at the sensory table, why do we have a arbitrary, when we think about that for young children too, we create these artificial barriers. Everybody has to sit with pretzel legs. Well, I don't know, last time we sat with pretzel legs, it was not very comfortable for me, you know? And so I think it's those same things you're talking about. Those routines that kids consistently give us feedback aren't working for them, which turns into us being really irritated. It might behoove us to look at the feedback they're giving us.
Yeah. And look at the adult behaviors that might be contributing to kids' inability to meet our expectations. Right. And I think it's so funny that you say that because I haven't thought about that in a while, but I remember when I was teaching in a classroom, I was an early interventionist doing home-based service in North Carolina. And then I took a job teaching in an inclusive pre-K classroom in North Carolina in Raleigh. And it was through a state-funded, at the time it was called More at Four, early childhood investment by the governor at the time. And it was a really great program. And I had lots of opportunity to have really phenomenal mentors who were in my classroom and really helping me to become a critical and inclusive teacher. Now, I say all that knowing and acknowledging that I made more mistakes than I did anything right. But I had the opportunity to learn from smart people. And I remember going to the training. We used creative curriculum, and I was at a creative curriculum training. They started this new thing where we were being asked to have students move their names from center to center. And I mean, this had to have been, I don't know, 18 years ago or something. It was a very long time ago. And I remember being like, okay, I get it. I get the theory, right? I get the idea behind it, but I just don't understand how adding, like, I just want them to like kind of pick up what they were working on and choose something else. That to me feels like the work that we're doing here. And if I add this other piece and I become hung up on the compliance with that, I'm shifting their thinking with that compliance, right? And not thinking about what they want to work on next. It feels like a distraction. And I didn't feel like we were at the point where we could add another variable to,
right, or make a transition more complicated.
Yeah. And it required them to do some kind of higher level math and problem solving where they would have to go to the center and, you know, figure out if they were the missing chair and the musical chairs, is there not room for you here? Versus those more natural opportunities to problem solve and to have those conversations where we're like, oh, it looks like there are a lot of friends at the water table. And what do we think we should do about that? It kind of took all of those opportunities away. And that I remember talking to my co-teachers and being like, I just am not sure how I feel about this. And I'm sure, you know, at the time, I'm sure I was like, I'm probably not understanding it. It's got to be the best thing, but it was a real challenge for me. So I didn't know that was, or I guess I wasn't aware that that was still a thing we're doing.
Oh my gosh, it is. So in terms of kind of getting down to the, like, what is the takeaway? There are lots of things about understanding the history and about thinking about when we even hear it come out of our own mouths, sort of that we, they perspective, or we have things divided up into this group and that group, like we've kind of naturally created groups and paying attention to that. And then I think you gave some really great questions to reflect on of how do we make sure that everyone has a space in the classroom and it's a meaningful enough space that others notice when they're gone. And then I'll keep on my soapbox about, and that there are things that are interested, like those kids want to be in the classroom, which I think comes with that community building. And then you just talked about sort of dismantling barriers and thinking about what are those. And sometimes we think about dismantling barriers as like these big systems barriers, but you and I are talking about like really tangible things. Like, could we all agree on the header for the paper? Or could we actually just always use the same song to transition? Because that's really helpful for some kids. Is there anything else that, and we could talk for hours, but is there anything else that if you were talking to new teachers, your grads from the last couple of years that are out in the field, that you would say to them or encourage them with?
I think that one of the things I was thinking about in preparation for talking with you is that in this moment, this post-George Floyd moment, this time where we're seeing lots of diversity, equity, and inclusion titles popping up in our schools and programs, mm-hmm. and different, you know, training opportunities. And now we have a diversity specialist or a diversity resource officer or something, these different things that are happening. I really hope that we can collectively begin to realize that when we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we are consistently segregating specific kids relatively arbitrarily when it comes right down to it from our classrooms and our school communities, we are not doing diversity, inclusion, or equity. One of the things that has been interesting as I've been, obviously I'm involved in a lot of anti-racist work, and anti-ableism is also a part of my own journey of learning. And I've been really surprised by the ways in which people are using the word inclusion in school settings without addressing special education, mm-hmm. and the ways in which it is exclusionary. And so I hope that we can sort of talk about what inclusion has meant in school and what exclusion has looked like. Because when we think about Black and brown children have definitely been excluded at disproportionately high numbers in various means, but special education has always been the modality. And we have used special education as a tool to funnel Black and brown children out. So yes, Black and brown children have historically not been included, but special education has been the means with which we have used to exclude them. And so when I think about diversity, equity, inclusion, and I see a lot of people doing really great work around LGBTQ, gender identity, and anti-racism in schools, we continue to not be addressing special education as a system and the ways in which it's implemented in our classrooms and in our schools. And so I'm kind of always trying to help people remember that when we use the word inclusion, we have to look at who has historically been excluded and acknowledge those systems that we have used in order to do that excluding. And that is really new for a lot of new teachers. They just haven't thought about special education in that way. So mm-hmm. that I think is really important, because we're all, I think, in a position right now where we're engaging in a lot of this work around anti-racism, but we cannot have that conversation in schools without addressing ableism and special education.
Thank you so much. I feel like thank you so much. Thank you so much to Dr. Jen Newton for joining me today. You can find her on Instagram at Teaching is Intellectual. Teachers, we love you. We are here for you. We are cheering you on from a distance as you continue to learn about and live out inclusion in early childhood classrooms. Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is recorded, edited, and produced by Christine Lippard. Music by Jason Lippard. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Tiny Chairs.